This is Ray Mock, the Executive Director of the Miami University Alumni Association. As a dues-paying member, you have shown a desire to maintain your connection to Miami. Our goal is to help you keep that connection strong. With these Your Connected audio podcasts, we hope to bring you a little bit of Miami in an easy-to-use and informative format. Check back regularly to keep up with the latest happenings around campus. Hear what's being taught in the classroom, and learn how alumni can continue to play a key role in the university. So sit back and enjoy these lectures from some of Miami's most accomplished faculty. And best of all, there will be no quizzes or exams.
Yesterday you heard the reflections of their time when they have spent there an entire semester. But try and explain it a little bit more concretely what we're actually doing. And then if we still have time, I'll share with you some of the theory or the philosophy, the educational principles that underlie what we do. And I think is one of the reasons why we got this award. This slide's kind of neat because everything that's colored, it's a neat slide, one of my students did it, everything that's colored here is over the Rhone. And you can see where it is vis-a-vis the downtown and the larger towers, commercial towers.
So, you may be going to see this. Why is it called
Over
the Rhone?
I will.
Oh, good. Okay.
And while you orient us to the area, where's the river?
The river is further down.
So this would be north of the river?
Yes.
Okay. And north of the downtown.
And north of the downtown. I'll have a map
familiar with Cincinnati or that.
Right.
I'm just trying to picture where this is.
We're from Cincinnati.
We grew up in Middle America.
Oh,
you're
aware.
Okay. So you're aware.
Okay. So I basically start this kind of talk with four dates. 1981 is when I, quote, entered the community. I lived in Oxford with my wife Janice, and we still live there. But I entered the community as a way to go looking for a particular community. I was also attracted by the architecture that you see in there. So 1981 is my first involvement in Over the Rhone. And since that time, I'd bring students down on a sporadic kind of basis. But it wasn't until 1996 that we hit upon something that's called design-built. And that's exactly what it means. I'm in architecture. I'd bring architecture students down. And we would design the interior alterations of buildings and then build that out. Now, I was pushed into that by a student, actually. Student said, "Tom, I'm sick and tired of doing hypothetical projects. I would like to do something that's real, that actually makes a difference." I was actually on the board of Nonprofit Housing Development Corporation, and so I got that student in touch with that board, and there was a small little project that we did. Three of them took on the responsibility of doing a design-build project, and at the end of that, we all went, wow, this would be really cool. We need to do this. And from 1996 to 2006, for 10 years running, every single semester, in architecture, we were doing design build on this basis. You know that we're about 50 minutes away from the downtown, Miami is. And every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 o'clock, we would meet at the loading dock at Alumni Hall, drive down about an hour, try and get 3 good hours of work in on these buildings, and drive back. It's like the most inefficient way to be doing design build work. But that's what we did for 10 years. So 2006 is the fourth date. I didn't give you the third one. But the fourth date is 2006, which is when we actually started the residency program, in large part to get people to be able to work on buildings more full-time, as opposed to the three-day-a-week thing. And 2002 is in the middle, when we're doing this design-build work, and the students would come up to me sort of in the late 90s, and began to hit them, and began to hit me, but they were the ones that pushed it again. They said, "Tom, we're learning a lot about architecture, design, and building, but we're just not learning enough about the community because we're in and out. We're trying to be as efficient as possible to do this design build." So that led to the idea that why don't we try and create a center that's open to the whole university. Faculty could bring their courses down there. We could bring people in from the community because they're right there. And we became a center in 2002. This is a picture of Amy Stovall. And this was taken in April 2001. And I mentioned this very briefly yesterday. But in April 7th of 2001, there was the tragic shooting death of a young black man who was fleeing from the was a white police officer and Timothy Thomas kind of met at the back of a building, sort of in an alley, and the young man was shot. And the place didn't explode immediately, but there was a lot of anger within the black community because between 1995 and 2001, 15 people had died in some capacity at the hands of police, all of them black men. And this happened on a very early Saturday morning, and it wasn't until Monday that people could go to City Hall, would flood City Hall and try to find out what was going on. They felt that they weren't getting the answers that they wanted to get, and the place kind of rioted. Went, the biggest riot since California, Los Angeles in 1992.
And the police altered their suppressive activity?
Yes, it's actually gotten much better. The police community relationships has really increased.
Most of us black men work on Orange, I think all of them.
Well, I mean, there might have been, you know, it's hard to. You know, in some cases, there was probably justification of use of force for the killing, but in some cases, there were some real sketchy things. In this particular case, I mean, the police officer that killed Timothy Thomas, I don't think is racist or something like that. But it was, but basically, he was found not guilty of everything, whatever he was charged for. And one of them was obstruction of justice because he changed his story three times as to actually what happened in that alley. But he was still this is a the picture is taken by a person by the name of Jimmy Heath, and I'll come back to talk a little bit about Jimmy in a minute. But he's a photographer that recently died, and he lived in the neighborhood, and he found his life again when he fell in the hard times, and he found himself at the drop-in center, and fabulous photographer. But he was on the streets at the time. I showed this slide yesterday. It's the one to begin to, you know, 30,000 people in 1950, mostly white. Now maybe 7,600, 2,000 to the last census count. Majority of the people are below the poverty line. And these kinds of things are still going on. And it's an area that's changing rapidly. This is the slide. So this is the downtown. This is the river. And this blue line, kind of heading on over into here, is that this was the site of what was part of the whole Miami-Erie Canal system, because if you remember your geography, you know, the Ohio River kind of bows back up around Cincinnati. And so it's the closest point to the Great Lakes, to Toledo. And in the 1850s, 40s, that sort of thing, mid-1800s, there was a large German immigration that began to come into Cincinnati, and they began to locate, you know, sort of in this whole shaded area. It's a weirder configured neighborhood, but that's overgrown, including that area there. And so people began to refer to the Germans an awful lot, and they began to call the canal the Rhine, and that was the area over the Rhine, and the name stuck. And that was where it came back to the Ohio River. These are some of the more scenographic shots. I, as you know, I grew up in Los Angeles where everything is made out of stucco. And so seeing buildings made out of brick and having cornices and bases, I got some more shots to show you. And as I mentioned yesterday, it's long vistas punctuated by, you know, church steeples, that kind of thing. You see the hillsides in the background because we are still in the basin just north of the downtown district. I always like to use this slide for architecture students because you talk about the relationship between the monument, and the texture. These are all gorgeous buildings, but they don't stand out as monuments. Music halls should. Home of the ballet, the opera and the symphony, built in the 1870s. This is a very illustrative slide, and if you begin to look at this, you begin to see that each building is only about 20 feet. So this begins to talk about the distribution of economic power at the time, such that the developer A can only control and build about 20 feet of streetscape. Developer B, developer C, developer E, you know, you get the point. It's the aesthetic of many hands. Now, while these are the more scenographic shots. Take a look at this. This is where you see those 20-foot wide increments, but look how far back these buildings go. And so, kid, this is the alley. Here's the alley over here. That's an actual street. And so where do these buildings open up? And where do you have sort of an interior of the block as an escape from the hustle and bustle of the city? Doesn't tend to work that way. And in fact, this is sort of like Cincinnati's Harlem. Basically, how you operate in this environment, you will kind of walk down sort of an exterior passageway. Generally, in the middle of the building is where you'll have a stair, only one stair, and that might be a unit to the back or a unit to the front. So it's extremely dense. In 1950, there might have been 30,000 people there. There's estimates that in the 1880s or 1900s, there might have been 80,000 people. So it's like really quite incredible. The density was, so you had people in these back units, people in front units, and they were pretty much all flats, which means that, you know, just that was a unit, you know what I mean? They just sort of stacked on top of each other. So that's Over the Rhine, a little bit about Over the Rhine. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the forces that have acted on it. So we're in part two here. And talk about suburbanization. These are the things that I'll probably touch on here. And suburbanization, I love this because it refers to, you know, GIs coming back, and there was a GI Bill in 1944, General Electric, but, you know, drawing the house, the whole notion of the American dream being kind of constructed ideologically around the single-family house. It's important to talk about suburbanization from a number of factors. When I ask students, okay, so what contributed to the suburbs? Why did, after 1950, did the suburbs kind of explode in this country? We've always been a country that there's always been some suburban development. Basically, as you can imagine, in the 1880s or the 1900s, we had really pretty cities and things like that. For people with greater wealth, who probably want to move out into the hilltops in Cincinnati. They couldn't do it in Cincinnati until sort of the late 1880s, or I think it was somewhere in there, because they finally developed the inclines as a way to get up there. But often the students talk about cars and freeways, but the Freeway Act didn't happen until 1956, which was, I have a slide of it, it's the Highway and Defense Act. I think the kicker, to me, was in 1934. 1934 was the establishment of the Federal Housing Authority. A good thing. I mean, because it was coming about in the Depression as a way to try and meet the needs of people who have fallen into the Depression and have lost their incomes and so forth. It was Federal Housing Administration sort of intervened in the mortgage system of finance in this country in a certain way that was trying to sort of liberalize the mortgage system of finance. Most people in the country before the war rented. Terms of ownership was generally you had to put 40% down. 15-year mortgage, still had a big lump sum due at the end of that period. So FHA comes in and says maybe 10% down, a 30-year mortgage, basically brings home ownership possibilities to a lower middle class. And a couple of provisos here. The requirements for FHA is that they were organized and oriented towards new construction. The regulations were organized and oriented towards new construction, not rehab. They were also oriented towards single-family house-type construction, not multifamily type construction. But the kicker was that there was a neighborhood evaluation process. And if you were a person that worked at any powerful corporation, let's say you were the CEO, you were making tons of money, you could handle any loan for a reinvestment in a neighborhood that was undergoing some transition, racially, you were not going to get that loan. Because banks and insurance companies began to do a practice that they called redlining, which was literally the case of sort of redlining around districts. And even if you were capable individually of the loan, you were not going to get it. And so basically, between 34 and 1964, $138 billion in FHA loans went out. 98% of those loans went to white people. And these people were going to the suburbs. We tried to get an FHA loan when we tried to buy our first house. We did not get that loan because the architectural configuration was not in line with their requirements. So basically, to the hardcore punchline here is that perhaps unintentionally, but by default, what happened here is that we have now sort of produced a geographically racially segregated environment. We are now geographically racially segregated than we've ever been in U.S. history. So we primarily have sort of white suburbs and inner cities that are characterized more by people of color. Oh, I guess it was 54. 54 USA Defense Act. This obviously not just helped shift economic production to the suburbs, but people could move out to the suburbs and live out there. This is my slides for the changing global economy. This is a slide of San Francisco from 57, 69, 73. I mean, you know, these towers really start, you know, we don't build like this anymore, sort of that, you remember that 20 feet and over the Rhine. It's now basically, you know, an 1800 city trying to exist in the 21st century reality. This is a slide that begins to actually, if you could build this, and across the street, you still have all that kind of texture. You know, the economic pressure that puts on that, why wouldn't you tear it down? I mean, here are some of the larger development parcels that we have today. Here is the border. This is all over the Rhine, and not all of it, but over the Rhine is the border here. That was the canal. But this is the downtown. And so, you know, you still have some of that texture here, like the places in there or like in there. And so, you know, that 20-foot wide building stock is all over the Rhine, but, you know, wow. This one is a little unfair because it is the convention center, and you just need a big block of space for a convention center. But this is the extension to Procter & Gamble's headquarters. But, you know, I mean, they had to do what they did. It's fine. That works down there. But up here, it just starts getting to be kind of, it's that kind of pressure.
What about all those condominiums that were built down there by the river? Have they filled up, or are they still out?
Well, right now, this is a very old slide, because that doesn't even exist anymore. The ballpark is here, the Bengals are over here. This area in here is being called Banks, and there are plans, and they are actually moving forward. They're constructing now. They plan to put in kind of a whole new, there's condos and housing as well as other kinds of facilities. The National Underground Railroad Center Museum is there. So, I mean, there's a lot of, finally, there's a lot of focus and activity back on the waterfront. I mean, this just illustrates sort of a problem. I mean, when you have that kind of texture, these big units come in, like, and this is the parking entrance for this building, you know. And so this was, and that part of the street is still pretty nice. A lot of nice shops, kind of like the Miracle Mile kind of idea, you know, that's going on there. There's smaller shops, boutiques and stuff. Well, let me go on a little bit. Remember the slide of San Francisco. So a lot of cities were starting to undergo major financial commercialization of downtown. But it was also coincident with the deindustrialization of America. And we started to change as a country from manufacturing base to a service economy, a nation of hamburger stands and so forth. In the 50s, 1.5 million blacks came north in the 60s. And then, you know, so when they're coming north in the 50s and the 60s, the white society is out. Blacks never had the mobility. This transformation from manufacturing and the deindustrialization has basically killed the black working class in this country. Result, rising unemployment, fewer benefits, health care, more jobs without a future. Here's a very interesting slide. This is from Robert Reich, who was the labor secretary for Clinton. And so he'd be understood as liberal, I think, but the here is sort of these by quintile, the bottom 20%, the next up, the top 20%. So between 47 and 73, this is what people rose in terms of wages. The bottom fifth of the population rose the most in terms of wages across that period. They were between 74 and 2000. But, like, you know, when people talked about a rising gap between the rich and the poor, I think this begins to illustrate. That more and more wealth is being accrued by the top 20%. And probably if you just took a look at the top top 1% or something, it'd probably be way off the charts. You're starting to see rising inequality. You're starting to see an increase in homelessness. Between December 2007 and now, there's been a 61% increase in homelessness in the country. In Cincinnati and northern Kentucky, there's 6,000 children who are homeless. The average age is 9 years old. At the drop-in center in Over the Rhine, the second largest shelter in the state, they have not seen their numbers go down at all. And even certainly in the wintertime, they see their numbers go up. But I remember at the end of last winter coming into last summer, they always expect the numbers to drop. The numbers actually went way up. So then add to the homelessness two more medical epidemics. In the 1980s, you had the spread of crack cocaine in the inner cities all across the United States, then as well as AIDS. So when you have these massive, so you begin to think about this, so you see changing global economy. Changing global economy, which is basically resulting in big shifts. You see a rising inequality, rise of homelessness. You add these medical kinds of epidemics. Then you have something like this, gentrification versus equitable development. The secret of becoming rich for life may be hidden in a house like this. And to people that I align with, gentrification is a very bad term. They want equitable development. But gentrification means something very specific. It doesn't mean just upscale development. It doesn't mean just new development. Everybody that I align with want development. They want development. They don't want to see drug dealers on the street. They want to see jobs with futures. They want to see growth and change. They want to see more population come into Over the Rhine. Remember, there was 30,000 one time, now there's only about 7,500. The actual Cincinnati 2002 comprehensive plan for Over the Rhine calls for trying to get it up to 24,000. So we need to, quadruple the population. So we need people to come in. That's not the issue. Gentrification means something specific to the people. Gentrification means development that basically is not inclusive, and as property values rise and rents rise and things like that, these people don't have any tenure, and therefore they are pushed out. So the great question before America, can you actually develop equitably? So that, because the language is quite good, the language on the part of everybody says, Over the Rhine should be everybody's place. Anybody who wants to live in Over the Rhine should be able to live there. We shouldn't be displacing any current residents. So the principles and the goals are really quite good, and they're articulated by everybody, from CEOs to the homeless to the leaders on the street. But the great question is, can we really do that? And so when you really begin to take a look at Over the Rhine in terms of all these factors that have occurred, you have 400 buildings standing vacant, you have a high degree of joblessness, major gaps between the rich and the poor. We have basically what my fear is that through economic shifts and perhaps even political shifts, we have deprived people of the means to actually support themselves, at least in Over the Rhine. And so the word that I like for this is this one. I think politics of disposability, surplus humanity, succession of struggle, incarceration logic, these are by different people. And Arjuna Padurai came up with this term called the condescite. I think all these terms are similar terms. They're all trying to explain the same thing, although they use different terms for it. So surplus humanity. World cities have become a dumping ground for a surplus population working in unskilled, unprotected, low-service industries. The condescite, it sounds death by economic means, but that's not what it means. It means a worldwide tendency to arrange the disappearance of the losers in the great drama. This is what my fear is in terms of a place like Over the Rhine, or in terms of looking at world conditions, that this is what urban policy is now. That we're actually beginning to sort of walk away from our responsibility as a public, as a nation, to sort of meet the needs of all residents and citizens. And so it's with that as an analysis that we bring our students to. We bring our students to this kind of environment. And you saw this slide yesterday. This is the first cohort of 2006. And what we do is that this is a mural that we did not do, but the Over the Rhine People's Movement, but it is on the wall of our center. On the other side of this wall is the center. And so we have this kind of relationship with this group of people, special relationship with the Over the Rhine People's Movement. Oberon Gibson Movement has been in existence for 30 years, and they have been trying to address homeless issues, the community development issues, landlord tenant relationships, artistic production, cultural production, things like that. And so the role of the center is to be multidisciplinary. Students, faculty work collaboratively with neighborhood organizations. Students can do research, but the kinds of questions that they investigate often comes out of a dialogue with community leaders as to what kind of information and what kind of learning do we need to have in order to become, you know, a little bit more focused in what we're doing. We mentioned this a little bit yesterday, so where the program works. There's three courses. I teach a course that's called The American City Since 1940. There's a course on service learning. That course has actually been taught by people from the neighborhood. There's another course that shifts around. This past semester, Alfred Joseph, Family Studies Social Work, taught a course on family poverty. Next year, Marcia England on geography will teach a course on cities of difference, these kinds of things. They get 15 hours of credit, but the whole point is that they're immersed in the school of life, integrating their academic I mentioned this yesterday. Not charity model, not a blessed leash model. We're trying to assist. And I had some language in there that the language of help is not very helpful. Let me explain that. Because I find that there's one of the women down there, Bonnie Neumeier, she has a saying. It's an Aboriginal saying that she's extracted from people of Australia. It's something like, if you have come down here to help, basically go away. If you are coming down to walk with us and learn with us because your liberation sort of matches up with our liberation, then let's work together. It's that kind of ethic. Students in particular, and I'm talking about students, I'm not saying that help and trying to be helpful is universally a bad thing. But students often have this notion that we're going to go help these people, but it means we're going to go fix. And that's what we're trying to sort of work against. By trying to use the word assist. By assist, that means sort of says to the students, we're going to go down, we're going to learn, we're going to engage, and by walking with people, we will learn how to sort of attach ourselves to things that are already in motion. It's not like we're coming down with the fix to sort of solve these people and create their issues. I want to go now to talk a little bit about these things. I showed the slide yesterday. This is Annalise Neumeier. She was in the fall's 2006 cohort, but now is the director of child care development at what's called the Peasley Neighborhood Center. Community advocacy. We have all kinds of meetings in our space. It is used for meetings all the time. That's a very powerful thing where we try and have very deep, productive conversations with leaders and across state boundaries. I mean, we have some of the top CEOs in our space. We're always, I mean, this is not about just sort of talking to one side at all. This was a very interesting thing. In fall 2004, there was a charrette, what's called a charrette, a kind of a weekend long experience that was done, co-sponsored with a group that's called Architecture for Humanity. Not Habitat, but Architecture for Humanity. And a person by the name of Cameron Sinclair, very young guy, probably early 30s, kind of started this operation, and it's a fabulous operation. They're sort of very internationally focused. They're often the first ones into places like Haiti and stuff like that to try and begin to put housing back online and begin to reinforce services and get water systems back up and things like that. They've done a lot of work all around the world. And actually, 60 young architects from across the country came to Over the Rhine, spent a weekend looking at questions and issues and kind of coming up with little designs and proposals and things like that. So we do a lot of that kind of work too. The design build, and I want to show you some of this design build work. Students love to get dirty. They love demolishing things. And so I want to show you a couple projects of what we've been able to do. This is a little storefront that we were asked to turn it into a little laundry. Here's the floor plan. It's just a room. You got 1, 2, 3 washers, 1, 2, 3 dryers, here's a bathroom. Then you see these two black lines, you go, what is that? And the students were adamant. They wanted to do something with the lighting. They did not want to do something that would be like fluorescence 4 feet on sand. And there was a little bit of city money for this project, and this is what the students did. And so those black lines were actually the infrastructure support. And then you basically have kind of poplar 2x4s. You have basic fluorescence, you know, fluorescence. They're not 4 feet on center. And this was just a nice little project. It's also a little meeting room. You could put a table back in here. So it's kind of a laundromat meeting room thing. This area is in kind of a difficult area. It is coin operated. The area has been vandalized twice. Once there was paint thrown on the walls. But this thing has never been touched. And I don't know if it's not that high off the ground. It's not like you can't jump up and touch it. But it's never been touched. The other thing that this began to do, this project was accomplished in 1999. And one of the neat things about it is that there's a saying in the neighborhood. They're saying, we want housing that's decent, safe, and sanitary. We want housing that's decent, safe, and sanitary. Okay. That's fine, but it's also kind of a repressed sort of set of goals. This began to change the conversation. This one began to say, hey, decent, safe, sanitary, and why not beautiful? Why not interesting? Is design that might be in a magazine something that only more rich people can have, or you know, more middle class and wealthier people can afford? Why can't good design be a commodity that comes to us as well at the lower end? So begin to open things up. I want to show you this project. This is a renovation of a unit. They were having a hard time renting this unit, and I began to understand why. Show you a couple things here. We have a wall. There's a wall. You can see there's a door here, and there's a door here. And on the other side of the wall is a hallway, and then there's also a stairwell back there. And we begin to realize we don't need this. I'm standing more or less in the living room. So you begin to see how we're blowing away this wall. We don't need it. And on the edge of the stair, there was a wall there. We blew that wall down. And then, of course, when you blow these walls out, you have the responsibility of like, oh, we're going to have to put some kind of stair railing. This was back in the day. This was really 2000s, 2001, 2002. So this was on the Monday, Wednesday, Friday afternoon basis. And we had four students say, your job is to do this stair. All of it. You figure it out. And actually, when you leave students to it and their creativity comes out, that's what they do. Mm-hmm. There was a person, I brought a person who was a visiting critic. He was an architect out of Amsterdam. And he walked in because you could see here the front door. The front door, actually these doors were discovered. One was built in a wall. And there was four students that just had this front entry to do. And they took 10 layers of paint off these doors. You know, they built in a new transom and new lighting. And then you can see, as soon as you walk in, this is sort of that stair. This guy walks in and goes, oh, wow. He said, this in Amsterdam easily would go for $1 million. And right now, there's a family living in it, and they're probably paying $400 a month. These are some details. Architects get excited about that. This is the bathroom. There was a group in the bathroom. When you see, basically, you can see the way the studio works. They're sort of like little teams. You have to concentrate on this. The students in the bathroom go, I don't want to be in the bathroom. You know, but this is what they do. Everything in here. So they have this interesting way of doing the sink that kind of comes off the wall. Some exposed shelving, lighting, the mirrors, and things like that. The other thing is that students thought that door in the kitchen, they said, we want to do some concrete countertops. I didn't know how to do concrete countertops. I mean, you know, do the research, look at my home building. They did. They made a connection to a concrete plant in Dayton, which is, you know, a little bit above middle town there. And they got to pour into frames that they made, you know, under ideal conditions in a plant. And the people in the plant were happy to work with the students. They came back down and opened them up, and this is, that's concrete. Mm-hmm. It's a concrete kind of, that's where the oven is going. This is where the refrigerator will go. You give people a very different kinds of qualities. You get people who've never picked up a hammer before in the design build series, and then you get people that have some really amazing skills. We, one semester, had a guy who was just like, oh my gosh. And he went to Lowe's, he went to Home Depot, and he said, Tom, I think I could build them better, cheaper. Okay, go for it. I just got out of his way. He was in the shop. He just pounded these babies out and loved doing it. And he's a shop guy now. He's a designer builder now. He just loves designing things. This is a fabulous little project. This is a commercial project. And this is called Venice on Vine. And so happy to be a part of this project because this is a pizzeria and Subway shop. There's also a food catering operation that happens here. And this is run by Dominican nuns as a job training program to hire hard to employ people. So people who come out of prison and can't find work and things like that, they work here for a year, they develop a resume, our students work with these people, helping to tutor and help people get their GEDs and all this kind of stuff. And so this was a nice little design build project that we did. Also, this was a collaborative project with the University of Cincinnati.
It's called again.
It's called Venice on Vine.
Vine,
V-I-N-E.
And it's across the street, so you can sandwich.
Yes, this is right across the street from us. And so we're always over there all the time having slices of pizza and stuff. This floor is very interesting. The floor is inexpensive when you consider that, student labor is free. Okay, so, but basically what this floor is, you can see them here, laying the floor down. They basically went to all kinds of tile places and just give us your crap. Give us your scrap and crap and all that kind of. All they did was cut it. I mean, you can see there are all kinds of different lengths. They just cut it to the same width. Now, it's a highly labor-intensive floor, but with student labor, it's free. So, but anyway, it's gorgeous. It's a very, very cool floor.
Mm-hmm. I have two questions.
Yeah.
You had teams working on the front door, the bath.
Right.
Is there a general consensus of what the final goal is so you don't end up with a gothic bathroom and a modern...
That's a good question.
Yes. Here's an example. Because there was some kind of dialogue here. Like, here you got these exposed things here.
Right. This all seems to come together, so there has to be a central...
A little bit of that going on in the kitchen.
Right.
That's one side, that's the other. I mean, you couldn't do this all exclusively. All the conversations about the design are always happening in the group and with me and the other person that runs this, works with me, like John Blake, is now our community projects coordinator for the center, kind of like an assistant director of sorts. We were working together. Also, all kinds of design ideas are passed by. The group that owns this building, they're called Over the Rhine Community Housing, a nonprofit housing development. They're always in the mix. They give us a lot of leeway because we've developed a track record of a sensible thing. But in the end, especially if there's something going to be controversial. But your point also, yeah, all the groups need to be talking to each other and hopefully learn from each other and crib stuff, crib good ideas, no competition. It's the pedagogy of the studio is all collaboration.
Is there a lead person or a lead group that has veto power in the end?
I have.
Yeah. All.
You do.
No. I mean, if there are disagreements, and there are, I mean, the whole point is to try and talk them out, and things like that. I mean, eventually, sometimes you might get something like, look, we're not going to be able to do that. This is too much money. We just can't. Those sorts of things. Sometimes budget is a big deal.
The wall is interesting.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's just wood slats. I mean, just wood that got glued together and just sort of applied as a layer. In the other room, this is the it's like a 25-foot by 25-foot room. It was all brick. And we came on in and put in some new walls, but kept a lot of the wall showing. Some ideas about, having cabinets and need for a lot of cabinets. This is where the administration takes place in this particular room. So there was things like this that students did. counter. I have a continuous counter that runs around the entire space.
Excuse me for interrupting, but, you know, these students are enthusiastic about doing these things, but there's a skill level to some of what you're showing us that my personal view would be quite beyond the ability of a lot of students. So where's this skilled labor coming from the community?
No. I mean, this is pretty much all student work. And so it's just like any other kind of learning experience. They have to kind of step up and learn it and all that kind of thing. And figure these things out. This is why a lot of this stuff is talked out and, you know, debated and collaborated on.
Have you ever made mistakes, or have they made mistakes and have to redo something?
Never. We never made mistakes.
Yeah, of course. So they have insurance.
I mean, but hopefully not a mistake that after you get something up like this and you go, okay, we got to take it down. That's not going to work. I mean, so you try and minimize those.
There was almost a serious BAFTA mistake. Built in the wall and somehow didn't slip the scene and they bought a surround tub or a tub at Lowe's.
Oh my goodness, yes, that's right.
And then
they went to Lowe's and they got talked into something by a salesperson there. It was a clearance thing. That was kind of interesting. And we had to get it down this way. There was sort of like a large built-in stand-in unit sort of thing. And then we started realizing, we can barely get it down this hallway. You know, the hallway is a little less than 3 feet. This thing is like 3 feet. It worked out, but it was very good. Just want to show you a project or two about what we, as a prop, a critical practice. Basically, we're doing artistic installations, trying to take art and conceive within the community's meanings about various kinds of questions. The point is to try and, you know, try and bring an awareness. Try and restore a suppressed history set. Trying to unsettle or disturb, be out of place a little bit, try and break the decorum. Here's an example of something. Now, this slide is a little unfortunate. And not only because the socks and the shirt don't match, but it looks like it's all about me. And this was back to Jimmy Heath. There was a little project that my students did by working with Jimmy Heath, the photographer in the neighborhood at the time. He was a person that ran something that was called the Center for Community Photography. And he worked with kids in the neighborhood, give them cameras. And it would be, they would take pictures and then he would get them to write. So it was a photography literacy program. And my students wanted to work with him. And what happened, this is a view of the inside of our center. Students had some ideas about, you know, kind of these old frames and windows and lenses and views and, you know, framings and things like that that were going on. But and then they didn't want to put anything, for the most part, on the wall. Wanted to do a different kind of exhibition where people sort of have to dance through the space. I mean, you have to kind of bend down, look at it. And on the backs of these photos, let's say, would be somewhere. You see some text right here. I have some other pictures of it. You know, so text, things like that. People would move around in the space. We had a big opening, and so the kids came, the parents came, community people came, Miami people came. And it was really quite a rich event. And we've done several of these kinds of things. And this was an interior thing. Here's something that happened last December. Students designed kind of an infrastructure here of support panels. And what this was is that this gentleman right here was running a one-day-a-week class at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. It's sort of like a fame school thing. You know, so they're performers. It's a magnet school in the community, and they may be painters, they may be photographers, artists, performers, and musicians, etc. He was teaching a photography class, and he got his students to go out into the environment, to learn about the environment, to shoot the environment, but also the School for the Creative and Performing Arts is going to be opening this fall, and it's built right across the street from the second largest homeless shelter in the state. So I'm like, And there's already, within the dominant media, there's always, will the drop-in center have to move? But he kind of, like, pushed the students into the drop-in center. They made amazing connection with the men's recovery program. People were going through alcohol addiction and things like that. And then they developed relationships, they wrote together, they took pictures together, and then there was this exhibition. And the testimonies that night were as rich as it you might have heard yesterday. How the men were changed, to look forward to the youngsters coming across, working with them, and how the youngsters also, their high schoolers and things, they were talking about the depth to the learning that they had. And it really talked about a richness, the synergy that can actually happen. This thing does not have to be separated. Anyway, this is some of the work in this. All these students right here were in the residency program last fall. Very quick, because we're running out of time. But I just wanted to show you this project. This, students were, we were asked to come on in and do something exteriorly. Again, talk about gentrification, talk about, you know, displacement, things like that. There was a hotel that was right here, a single-room occupancy hotel. It was a very well-functioning hotel. People lived in it for a night. People lived in it for a week. People lived in it full-time. We were asked to come on in because the community lost a battle. They wanted to save that, but it was torn down for upscale housing. So this makes the neighborhood wonder about economic mix. Is it really, you know, there's a lot of talk about that, but is it really being followed through on? Students did three interventions. The intervention was this thing here. And that was just simply a signifier. The red against the green trees would say, hey, something's going on. What's going on? This was only up for an afternoon. Then you begin to see this guy. There's like five of these things. There's silhouettes. Silhouettes. One back there, you know, down through the park. Students said, this is our statement about homeless people. Homeless people, we really don't want to look at them. We're not there. We look right through them. They don't exist. And that was their statement. But you begin to see right here, something is hanging in this void. And what the students found is that they tried to find the people, some of the people who were displaced from the Milner Hotel. That was the hotel's name. The Milner Hotel, they found these people. Some of these people ended up at the drop-in center. They uncovered their story, and they began to reinvest back into this void the lives of these people, some of the lives of these people that were displaced. The reactions were pretty interesting. A lot of people were like, I had no idea that there was a struggle over space in this particular part of the city, that there was this attempt to save this particular hotel. Other people were angry. Other people thanked us. It was kind of all over the place. This was sort of community leaders having a celebration of the fact it was on the fifth anniversary of the loss of that thing. So then this becomes a setting for a community to learn about its history in a deeper way, and also to introduce new people who are becoming educated about the questions and over the line, that kind of thing. The third intervention was that there was these plaques. They look like they're bolted into the floor of the city, but that's not the case. Students did get a permit for this. The city gave us a permit, allowed this to happen. But it begins to talk about the Milner Hotel. And over here, you have, you know, there's a lot of thinking in the leadership of Over the Rhine around the Cherokee people, the Trail of Tears, and they don't fall into this like equality of pain thing. I mean, what happened to the Cherokee is far worse than what's happened to the Milner. But the sort of being forced off your land and you know is something that they resonate with, and so students wondered if this was an attempt to socially cleanse the neighborhood. Raise a lot of questions. Jeez, I'm running out of time. Maybe I should just stop there. And it'll take about 5 minutes. I do maybe want to show, I go through these slides and talk about the various kinds, like we try and organize learning that engages community life and community pedagogy. Basically entails an analysis of society. We try and understand Over the Rhine within larger features. We try and engage with otherness on a deep level. This was a little bit of characterized what we do with the Edge of Crop stuff. Try and understand the workings of society, the forces that have acted upon neighborhoods and things. This is one that I learned. The Peasley Neighborhood Center has a motto: expression is the first step of oppression. person asked a question yesterday, like, I've characterized that we're sort of trying to look at how class and race sort of plays out in Cincinnati, and also to look at the relationship between oppressed and oppressor populations. And the question yesterday was, who are the oppressors in your mind? And I've been thinking about that question all day, and I was thinking about this. This is what I learned from the piece in Neighborhood Center. This is their motto. And one expression or one meaning of this is that certainly when you express yourself, you're asserting yourself as a human being, an agent in the world, you're acting, you're critically thinking, that kind of stuff. But I think the other meaning is better. Expression becomes a liberating practice when it is tied to an analysis of oppression. Now, that doesn't quite answer that person's question, like, who are the oppressors? And I was trying to say it was more of a structural and systemic thing. I mean, look, if there is racism at an institutional level that operates even beyond what people may feel if they're prejudiced or not, I think, you know, most people in society, let's say, don't want to be racist. But there's sort of racism that still inheres in society by the institutional arrangements. I mean, people are benefiting. And so if you wanted to try and work to overcome racism, would that mean that you would be against white people? If you wanted to try and overcome patriarchy that sort of oppresses women, they can't get through the glass ceiling and jobs and so forth, does that mean that you're against men? No. So it's more of a systemic, structural kind of condition that we're trying to think about here in terms of, we're not trying to target people and say, oh, you're the oppressor, we're going to work with you. That's not how we're thinking about this. It's more about trying to understand how the system works as a whole and try and find leverage. But we have aligned with those that are on the bottom end, the underserved, if you call them that, and try and work with them and learn from them and bring things along in a more socially just, equitable fashion. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this Your Connected podcast. Please check back for the latest podcast from your Miami University Alumni Association.